Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
आज जो पार्टियां यहां शोर मचा रही है.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país. Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome back to Season 2 of PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an academic endeavor where we seek to understand how law is used by rising autocrats to consolidate power or by those who are trying to resist those moves. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. In the last two episodes of this season, I'm interviewing two students who were engaged with PAL and the themes we are exploring through the project. Today I talk to Riley Horst, a former undergraduate student I had at the University of Oklahoma. Riley took several of my courses and did her honors research under my supervision. We then read extensively about democracy and current trends of democratic backsliding. Riley also stood out at OU for her activist work. In 2021, she helped write a petition that was submitted to the Inter-American Human Rights Commission to fight the execution of Julius Jones, a former OU student who received a death penalty sentence in what many understood to be an unfair trial. In the episode, we draw from her intellectual and political engagement on campus to reflect upon the issues we always reflect upon on the podcast. That is, what is happening to democracy and what law has to do with it. You will listen to the interview after a brief word from our sponsors.
Hello, I'm Tomás Díaz de la Rubia. I am the Vice President for Research and Partnerships at the University of Oklahoma, and my office is a proud sponsor of this podcast. Research at OU is thriving. Guided by OU's strategic plan, we're igniting and catalyzing research that changes lives. Learn more about our work at ou.edu/research.
Riley Horst, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This past academic year, you read a lot about democracy. I gave you a long list of books and articles. I asked you to conduct independent research beyond those readings and to follow debates such as those we have here on PALcast. During this time, you also completed your college degree requirements, your coursework, your internships, and we all know how transformative higher education can be, how it can lead one to think differently about things and to pay attention to details that, without the repertoire and the sensitivity we develop in college, we would not be paying attention to. Knowing what you know now, how do you define democracy and how does that differ from your previous understanding of it?
Well, the most basic, simplistic definition of democracy that I can give is that democracy is the government resulting from free, fair, and competitive elections. So the highest rulers of the land are chosen by the people. I did a linguistics minor as well, as you might know. So I was interested in the etymology as I was thinking about democracy and, reading about it through the research that I did for your class, as well as in some of the political science classes I've taken. And the Greek origins of the word translate to the rule of the people, which is, so it's the very base level. But what I've learned as I've been researching and doing this research is that this definition is actually, that's just kind of the beginning, and democracy is more of a continuum or a spectrum, and there's a lot more to it. So while elections are obviously significant, defining democracy solely in terms of how and if leaders are elected is maybe a little too simple, because these elected leaders could still be sort of like puppets of some other group, or there can be corruption. So while it may, a government may seem to be democratic, it may not actually be. So limitations on the power of democracy are also important. I think in the United States, we're often taught from a very young age that democracy is just a good government. Like, oh, like, that's the kind of government we have in the United States. It's good. We elect people. But just seeing democracy as just a good government where the people are represented by their elected officials makes it a lot less useful when you're studying and comparing, and can ignore the more nuanced issues and facets within democracy.
Considering this definition in which voting is just the beginning of democracy, how do you rate the state of U.S. democracy?
Well, to start with a more positive aspect of the state of United States democracy, despite claims by many politicians, instances of voter fraud in the United States are really rare. So the U.S. election practices, including like mail-in ballots, are fairly safe and secure. However, like false claims about election fraud have led to policies and practices that may make it more difficult for certain people to vote, which is an issue that's really important to me, is like accessibility of voting, because like I said before, elections are kind of a starting place for measuring democracy. So like ballots or ways to vote, such as mail-in ballots, are essential for increasing accessibility for democracy, but fear-mongering about fraud has caused those to be harder to obtain. I know in Oklahoma, during the pandemic, they allowed anyone and everyone to vote by mail-in ballot. But then with increased claims of election fraud and fears of that, despite the fact that those might not necessarily be true, they kind of pulled that back a little and made it harder to get mail-in ballots. And additionally, like going along the same line of voting rights and accessibility of voting, it's been common practice in the United States for many years to take away voting rights for felons. And so since the United States has some of the highest incarceration rates in the world, this is just an enormous population of people that don't get a say in who's representing them in government, which is significant considering the many issues surrounding the criminal justice system that these elected officials are deciding on. So these issues, along with like gerrymandering and the Electoral College, that have significant influence on the outcomes of the United States elections, are problematic. But after the elections are complete, then there are other like good and bad things about the American system. So it Americans love the Bill of Rights. Constitutional rights are very important, but the way that the United States system is set up is that it can be kind of unwieldy, which makes it harder for changes to be passed. So like for right now, it seems like there's an issue with striking the right balance between limitations on power and checks and balances, and still being able to pass legislation and make big changes. So like the legislative branch in the United States government is having a hard time passing anything because there's such a strong party divide. But the Supreme Court at the same time is moving to make huge changes that will like cause ripple effects throughout the rest of the country with their potential overturning of Roe v. Wade. So overall, I do think that the United States democracy is intact as far as voting practices are safe and secure, but they may not be accessible to everyone, and just the democracy alone isn't enough without protection of rights and actually being able to make changes within the government and pass policy and just make positive changes for the people.
One discussion I always engage with students in class is about democracy promotion. The idea that democracy is so good that it should be promoted throughout the world. And this is something that was very central, as we know, to U.S. foreign policy in the 20th century. However, here we are with democracy losing traction globally, as well as in the United States, as you were just saying. So how does someone from your generation see the value of democracy being promoted globally?
I do see value in democracy and how it, like at its face value at least, like protects the rights of the people, allows them to choose whoever the most powerful rulers are, and how it limits the powers of government. However, while this is the standard, not the standard, while this may be an ideal version of democracy, that's not always the case in practice. And I have a very hard time believing that there's a one-size-fits-all solution for any issue, including that of governance, that will work throughout the world, which is why I hesitate to say that the United States, the American, not the American, but the United States model would work worldwide. So I take issue with the idea that with democratization, states that are democratizing their governments should just adopt a model that replicates how the United States does things without taking into consideration unique cultural needs or beliefs that they may have. I think there are very few instances where a one-size-fits-all solution will work for anything. So I do see value in democracy and its promotion, but it's hard to put that into practice because it will not look the same everywhere and still be successful, in my opinion.
I want to move here from your studies to your action in college, because you did something that was quite extraordinary from my viewpoint, which is the work that you did in the Julius Jones case. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, the work that I did with the Julius Jones case was by far one of the most impactful and coolest, is the best word I can think of right now, things that I got to do in college during the fall of my senior year, so fall of 2021. That semester, I took a class called International Human Rights. So we learned all about the different international bodies and international law and things that are put in place to protect human rights on a global scale. So one of our major assignments for that class was to write a real case petition, like a mock petition, to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So for that assignment, I, as well as I think two other students, chose to write my petition on the Julius Jones case. This was a case that was occurring in Oklahoma at the time, but it had received national attention. Julius Jones was scheduled to be executed on November 18th, 2021, so during the semester that I was taking that course. I think the scheduled execution date was a few weeks or a month or so after the assignment was due, and it had received a lot of media attention because there were strong advocates who were arguing that Julius Jones was innocent. He should not be executed because he had not received a fair trial, and other factors that just he didn't should not be executed. So I wrote my petition, my mock petition at the time, I thought, to the Inter-American Commission based on rights guaranteed in the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man regarding Julius Jones' right to a fair trial, due process of law, and equality before the law. After I submitted this assignment, my professor, Dr. Moraes, emailed me and said, "Riley, this is like good work on this assignment. I think we could potentially actually submit this to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Is that something you would be interested in pursuing?" And of course, I was like, wow, yes, absolutely. I chose to write my petition on that case because it was something that I cared a lot about and had been paying attention to and following closely, because I didn't think that Julius Jones should be executed. So myself, my professor, and the other students who had written their petition on the case ended up working with the Justice for Julius campaign and some of the lawyers, attorneys that had been working on his case, because one of the requirements for submitting a petition to the ICHR is that you have to have exhausted all other appeals in that state. And so Julius had, his legal team had, he had no other appeals options left. All that was left was the possibility that Governor Stitt would commute his sentence. So it was a really rushed process, because it's normally quite a lengthy process to submit a petition to the ICHR, have them review it, and make a decision on the case.
And then what happened?
So in this case, we were requesting that they grant precautionary measures, which is to say that it was serious and grave danger, or it was such a quick like time circumstances that if they didn't act right away, irreversible harm would be done. So we ended up working with Mr. Jones' legal team and Dr. Moraes and some other colleagues of hers to edit and expand upon the petition that I had originally just written for a class assignment. And we submitted that to the ICHR. Dr. Moraes really did a lot of work. I was so impressed and really appreciated how invested she became in this project and how much time she put in outside of work and used her own personal connections to ask that the ICHR even saw it in time. And they did end up issuing precautionary measures on November 17th, 2021, so just one day before Mr. Jones was scheduled to be executed. And they granted almost everything that was asked for in the petition, and asked that the United States government like stay the execution until they had time to make a decision on the case, refrain from carrying out the death penalty, and just adopt any necessary measures to protect the life and personal integrity of Mr. Jones. And it ended up being that Governor Stitt commuted Jones' death sentence to life without the possibility of parole. And this decision came only a few hours before the scheduled execution. I remember that day, it was just a really emotional day. There were protests happening all over the state. And then when he finally released that decision, it was a really exciting moment. I was actually in my international human rights class when that decision was made. So we were talking, Dr. Moraes was talking about everything that had happened with the ICHR and just going over that. And then I got a news alert on my phone and like raised my hand and was like, he's not going to be executed. Governor Stitt commuted his sentence. But it was really interesting to just, because I had never thought that I would be involved with an international law body like that during college, and get to actually submit a petition and see the ICHR make a decision in our favor, and then his sentence be commuted, was something I'll never forget.
The reason why I ask this is because, as you know, one thing that's very important to me and to listeners of this podcast is the relationship between democracy and the rule of law. What did your work on the Julius Jones case taught you about human rights and how they can be tied to democracy and democratization? Based on your experience in this case, is law, particularly international law, an effective way to challenge arbitrariness?
I think that law can be a powerful tool, but it is often less effective than it seems like it should be, because courts often don't have strong enforcement powers. So in the Julius Jones case, it was a big moment for us, and it was really exciting when the IACHR decided in our favor. However, all they could do was ask that the United States government refrain from carrying out the death penalty, and which is, they don't have any way to actually enforce that, and there would not be any negative consequences if the United States had simply decided to ignore that, which is a common issue with court systems. They just often don't really have any way to enforce their decisions. In general, I think human rights are often closely associated with democracy and democratization. But as we see in this case, even countries like the United States, which, as we discussed before, are sometimes seen as the model for a democratic state, there are still like many human rights violations that occur within them, which is why democracy and democratization isn't valuable unless it comes with, or is less valuable, at least, unless it comes with the protection of those rights. I would like to believe that international law is an effective way to challenge arbitrariness because I participated in it with the Julius Jones case, and we did learn that the United States Department of State did notify Governor Stitt of the IACHR's decision, which may have been a factor in his decision to commute, but there's no true way of knowing how effective it was in this case. And it is often a matter of, does the government want to accept this decision or do they want to just ignore it? And while they may, and there may not be legal consequences for them ignoring it, there may be consequences in the public's reaction or in their relationship with international law, but they may not face any actual consequences, which makes it kind of, I don't want to say less hopeful, but it does seem that law, and especially international law, is only as powerful as the government will let it be.
What plans do you have for the future, and how do you think that your studies and your experience with democracy and the rule of law will help you going forward?
Ultimately, I hope to end up working in the nonprofit sector. There are a lot of things that I'm passionate about, but one of the biggest issues that I care about is the criminal justice system. The United States has a huge mass incarceration problem, and I think that my studies and experiences with democracy and the rule of law have allowed me to get a broader picture of what that looks like, of what the, just of rights, which are exceedingly important when considering the human, when considering the criminal justice system, and also of how law can be used as a tool, but also how it can be used, how it can be used as a tool for both sides. So the, I don't want to say the good guys and the bad guys, but how it can be used as a tool to keep people in prison or to get them out. I'm still figuring out exactly what my future plans will look like, but I do plan to go to grad school and then, and ultimately I want to work in the nonprofit sector, ideally and something and a sort of program or nonprofit that helps divert people from the criminal justice system. So lower the prison population.
Before I let you go, I wanted to give you a chance to address the next generation. What do you recommend to somebody who's just starting college and has an interest in democracy and the rule of law?
This is a big cliche, but just stay open-minded. What you think you're interested in at the beginning of college can always change. You can take classes that may not necessarily be within the major or discipline that you think. Just there's a lot of pressure in college to make decisions early and to make them quickly, and then like that's just your life from here on out, and I don't think that it has to be that way. I changed my major, I added things, I found interest as I went along, and I think just don't be afraid to branch out and take classes that aren't necessarily within what you think your field of study is. Take classes from other departments that just seem interesting, and don't be afraid to reach out to professors if you have an interest in things like democracy and the rule of law. Find a professor who studies that and just ask them if they have any readings to recommend, or ask them, I don't know, ask them if they have a podcast that you could listen to. And just follow your passions. Even something that starts out as a class assignment can be something more if you do it over something you're passionate about. Don't just do whatever you think might be the easiest way out. Do something that you think is really interesting.
That was Riley Horst. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here. It's an honor.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, drop me a note at fabio.isaiasilva@ou.edu.